many of us find ourselves repeating the same mistakes, stuck in the same bad habits, and we're often not really sure how or why it happened. Well, change is hard, but it's not impossible. For today's Please Explain, Dr. Richard O'Connor will help us overcome some of the most common self-destructive habits, including a big one I do, procrastination, excessive worrying, internet addiction, overeating, and self-medication. Actually, that's a description of myself. He's a practicing psychotherapist, the author of Undoing Depression, Undoing Perpetual Stress, Happy at Last, and Rewire, Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior. Richard O'Connor, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know. It's a pleasure to hear you. And if you'd like to join the conversation or want to find out yourself how to break bad habits, give us a call. Our number is 212-433-9692. So, Richard, full disclosure, we know each other because your book, Undoing Depression, was the basis of Good for Otto, a play that David Rabe did that I was in.
Yes, you did a marvelous job. And the play was a lot of, well, I can't say fun, but it was really an experience for me. It was amazing.
It was a great experience. Thank you. And it was a lot of fun. And I think, you know, you did amazing work with that. So getting back to this topic, you write that we actually have two brains. So what are our two brains?
Okay. Let me say, first of all, that in writing this book, I was heavily influenced by Daniel Kahneman, who wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. Kahneman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, although he's really a behavioral psychologist.
Okay.
I read Thinking Fast and Slow so other people don't have to. It's very difficult.
That's nice of you. So what did you learn from Thinking Fast and Slow?
Well, his thesis is that we really have two brains.
Mm-hmm.
We have a thinking and logical brain that we like to think of as ourselves, and at the same time, we have an automatic brain that does 99% of living for us without thinking. And these two brains don't really communicate very well.
That makes sense.
They don't. The conscious self is who we want to believe we are, but the automatic self is how we live. And I most of the book is focused on sort of learning to avoid the mistakes that the automatic self leads us into.
And that automatic brain, that side, it kind of can be trained, I think you say, right? What do you mean by that?
Well, the book is called Rewire because, I mean, that's the hopeful message of sort of the new neuropsychology. The scientists have been able to show that, you know, when we practice any habit, new connections form in the brain, new synapses, new neural pathways develop. One of the studies I really liked took a group of students and taught them to juggle for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 months, they could see changes in gray matter in certain areas of the brain. And then they had them stop juggling for 3 months, and they could see that those changes disappeared. And I think the same thing applies to any mental habit, including self-destructive habits.
Okay. So that's the automatic brain.
That's the automatic brain.
So the thinking brain is the more logical one, and it makes kind of tough decisions, but it can be wrong, correct, or right?
Of course. I don't mean to say that either brain is necessarily more reliable. I think we need a combination of both because, our feelings and our instincts and these unconscious processes can be very, very important information about the world. But when we act without thinking, that's usually when we get in trouble.
Okay. So why does the fact that our automatic brain, I guess, is so automatic, why is that reflex so troublesome for us?
Well, the automatic brain doesn't learn from its mistakes.
Hmm.
It's for one thing, it's shielded by all these defense mechanisms we have, rationalization and denial and projection and all that kind of thing. So we can find easy ways to believe that the mistake we made is not our fault or nothing to worry about or won't be repeated. So, you know, you wake up, well, I don't know if you've had this experience, but you wake up in the morning with a terrible hangover,
right.
And your thinking self, the conscious self, thinks, okay, I'm never going to do that again. I've got to reform somehow. But the automatic self is already making excuses for you. Well, you know, my friends led me into it. It's my wife's fault. You know, she doesn't understand me. I have to get loaded every once in a while.
Holy cow. So our brains are in that kind of constant conflict all the time.
Right.
All right. So you talk about some scenarios, just talking about that hangover, that scenario I cannot imagine ever having. So other scenarios like that, what is so important about recognizing them? And then is that a step toward changing that behavior?
Oh, sure. Recognizing that you've done something that's making you feel bad or feel foolish or feel pain is the first step in recognizing that there's a problem going on. And if you see that this is a pattern and you keep on doing it, then that's a really self-destructive behavior pattern, and you've got to do something about it.
Right. You've written in this book that much of the self-destructive behavior we inhibit, it comes from trying to avoid difficult feelings like anger and fear.
Yes.
And how does that work?
Well, you know, we're sort of socialized this way, unfortunately. Many of us, most of us are taught that certain feelings are unacceptable.
Yes,
in
that's
our
true.
Families or in society. We don't say things. We don't express our anger. We don't express our needs. We don't express our fears and insecurities. We keep them to ourselves. And as they become guilty secrets, and they gradually develop a sense of shame, as you were just talking with your last guest about.
Right.
Shame is a very, 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 very powerful force that keeps us stuck.
It does. It does, because there's not really a solution to the shame.
There's not.
So I know we don't have the, you can't solve the problems of all of us in this amount of time, but just as, how can we feel these emotions that we've sort of been trained to avoid without suppressing them or avoiding them? How can we kind of turn that around a little bit?
Okay, I'm glad you asked, because I think that's the first step. We can talk later maybe about how to overcome some bad habits, but I think the first step is preventing them.
Okay.
And that involves practicing mindfulness. And mindfulness is a hot topic right now. And I do have a meditation exercise that I think people should practice. And
okay.
It's very, very helpful. But mindfulness is really an effort to stay in the present moment, pay attention to detail, stop judging and categorizing. It's learning to observe yourself with a little bit of detachment, with what I call compassionate curiosity.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, that's a nice phrase, isn't it? A
mm-hmm.
friend of mine came up with that. Mindfulness helps us get underneath our defenses and makes us honest with ourselves, but kindly and lovingly so.
Oh.
So I really advocate mindfulness meditation practice 5 days a week,
All
seven
right.
days a week.
I like that. We're going to go to a call. We've got some, I guess people
okay.
really want to talk to you. Nick in North Bergen, New Jersey. Nick? We've got
Hello.
Dr. Richard O'Connor on the line. What's your question?
So I've got a... It's difficult. I think I know partly how I can try to stop, but eat a lot of, like, ice cream, chocolate, sugar, you name it. We have it in the house. I have two young kids, and it's just like an everyday thing. Even if I'm not hungry, you know, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to stop eating it. I mean, several years ago, I did it for about, like, 10 months or so, 10 or 11 months, and I lost a lot of weight.
Okay.
Just by cutting sugar out completely. So is there a way to, I mean, train myself to kind of, have it in moderate amounts, or am I supposed to go, you know, completely cold turkey, or what's the best way to try to reduce that bad part of my diet?
Oh, I love that question, Dr. O'Connor and
question.
Nick, because I struggle with certain food things like that too, and every time people say avoid it all, avoid, you know, it just, it kind of throws me into a tailspin. What do you do, Dr. O'Connor?
Well, I think there are certain things like alcohol and nicotine that people, at least some people, have to give up altogether. But other things like overeating or procrastination, other self-destructive habits, I don't think we're going to stop altogether.
Right.
So we have to learn to control them.
Are baby steps important to take with something like this?
Baby steps are very important to take. It's very important to congratulate yourself, to pat yourself on the back, to take it one day at a time, as AA says. It's a very, very important principle to be proud of yourself for having gotten through the day without overindulging. If you want to really learn to eat these kinds of foods more moderately, one strategy is what they call pre-commitment strategies. If you manage to eat a single ice cream cone, and that's what you plan to do,
right?
And you stop there, then you have to reward yourself for doing that.
Okay, can you reward yourself with another ice cream cone?
No. Of course, that's the problem with eating, isn't it?
I know.
People who overeat are really conditioned to food rewards.
But, right.
But you got to do something else. You got to call a friend. You got to go for a walk. You got to go see a movie. You got to reward yourself in a different way.
All right.
And probably if you really have a problem with overeating, there are not enough rewards in your life. So you could broaden your horizons.
Interesting. We're going to go to a call now from Eric in Croton-on-Hudson. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
Mine is sort of another eating, but it's a different twist. My issue is that I'm really good during the day, but I wake up consistently every single night, probably around 1:30 a.m., and I have a binge. And then I go back to sleep, and then I wake up feeling awful physically and emotionally.
This is a regular thing that happens with you, Eric?
Every night.
Now, you're not on that medication, that weird medication where people get up and sleepwalk and then they put their hands in a cake or anything, right?
No medication.
All right. Dr. O'Connor, what do you think?
Eric, have you talked to a nutritionist?
No, I haven't.
Well, I would suggest that as a first step because, I mean, it sounds like your body is craving something that you're not giving it. I'm not an expert in that kind of thing, but really talk to a nutritionist. But as far as curbing yourself, you know, in the middle of the night, early in the morning, it's really a tough time because our willpower is at its lowest ebb. We're most likely to give in to temptations, and our fears and our fantasies are all out there. Our nightmares come alive. So we're looking for something to make us feel better. We're looking for some security, something to make us feel good again. I would suggest you do pre-commitment strategies again. You know, before you go to bed, fix yourself a snack that you're going to eat when you wake up. A healthy snack, not too many calories, and you may want to do this in sort of successive approximations so you gradually taper off, but that you have a meal prepared for yourself when you wake up. You get up and you eat that. You go back to bed after that, and you practice my meditation routine when you're in bed, and it'll help you fall asleep.
Dr. O'Connor, when it comes to breaking a bad habit or trying to change like Eric is trying to change, is that willpower that you talked about, can we learn willpower or are we born with a certain amount of it?
That's the very, very hopeful message of the new psychology. Willpower is a skill. It's something we can learn. It's not something we're born with or
it
without.
It is a skill. Okay.
Yeah. And that's an excuse many of us make for our own bad habits. You know, I don't have any willpower. I never had. I'm hopeless. Or I don't have any willpower about this particular subject.
Mm-hmm.
That's a rationalization. That's not so. You can learn to develop willpower. You just have to practice consistently, and your brain will lay down these new neural pathways that make it easier for you to exercise self-discipline, if that's the point, in the future.
That's a good thing to know. I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with psychotherapist Dr. Richard O'Connor, who's the author of several books, including Rewire, Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior. This is Midday on WNYC, and we will be right back after a break. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard O'Connor, who is the author of, among other things, Rewire, Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, and Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior. Dr. O'Connor, when we left off, we were talking about willpower, and I think it's really important that you made that point, that willpower is not just something that's innate. It can be expanded, you can be trained, you can learn how to gather willpower.
You can certainly develop the habit of willpower. Yes, you can learn it, and it's very important to understand that. You're right.
Morphing from willpower, what is radical acceptance? I've heard that phrase bandied about a lot recently.
Okay, radical acceptance is a term that comes from dialectical behavior therapy, which was developed to work with people with so-called borderline personalities.
Mm-hmm.
Who are sort of classic self-destructive people. Radical acceptance means learning to accept yourself just as you are right now. Learning to accept that all the damage of the past, all the anger, all the bitterness, all the sadness, all the crap you're carrying around is there, but it doesn't have to dominate your life. It's you're who you are, and you have to make your life from this day forward. And so you stop judging yourself.
It's an outgrowth of mindfulness again, isn't it?
It is
not
an outgrowth of mindfulness. You stop judging yourself.
Right.
You stop being harsh on yourself.
Right.
I wanted to say a great deal of self-destructive behavior comes from people who have high standards for themselves,
mm-hmm.
impossible standards for themselves.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So these people typically have a what I call an inner critic. There's a voice inside that's always saying, well, you really screwed that up. You know, you'll never get it right. You're hopeless. You know, your mom or your dad was right. There's no point in you trying anymore.
Right.
This judging voice is really an artifact from the past. And it's sort of the effects of old scars in the brain.
So here's what's interesting. We've got those two sides of the brain that we were talking about, both the two brains. So there's that new brain that you're talking about, the one that's critical and all that stuff. But then research has shown that we all think that we're better than average. So there's that conflict. Because do we really think that we're the most honest, ethical person? I mean, how does that distortion and that conflict shape the way our thinking brains look at the world?
Okay, that's one way that the thinking brain gets us in trouble.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about what's called the socialization effect. We do tend to believe that we're all above average. Each of us is above average.
Right.
We tend to believe that we have more self-control than other people do. We tend to believe that we handle our liquor better. We tend to believe that we're more attractive than other people rate us. We tend to believe, incidentally, that we'll probably live a lot longer than we really will. We tend to believe that we're not subject to social influences. So we tend to believe we're immune from the media. And these are unique strengths of our own, and we're just sort of generally better than everybody else.
And we are mistaken.
It's interesting that you can have these two things going on in the brain at the same time. Rarely at the same time, but they happen within the same individual. There's this degree of self-hate, and then there's all this protection of self-esteem that makes it. And, you know, if you think that way, if you think that the rules don't apply to you, if you think, you know, that you're stronger than the average person, You're not a very nice person to be with.
Oh my gosh!
You know?
Oh dear, we're just creatures. We're just like, you know, children of the higher power, and we're
all
locked in a struggle. Let's go to Joy in Hoboken. She has a call. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Well, my thing is, and I've had this my whole life. I've always tried very hard to get certain things, get into grad school, get certain high profile or high, you know, level jobs. And like, I have to have them. And then as soon as I get them is when I immediately look for a way out. And I know that what I'm doing is the wrong thing, but it's like I have this compulsion to destroy my life and not really thinking about the consequences, but knowing it's not the right thing to do.
So Dr. Joy has no joy. What's up with that?
Right. It sounds like you really have very high standards for yourself, Joy. Are you a perfectionist?
Not really. I mean, I sort of shy away from... It's just I try for things. And I guess I've been lucky. But, you know, when you get something easily, I mean, most people would say, that's a great opportunity. Take it.
Yeah.
Instead, as soon as I get it is when I start second thinking myself.
Okay. Well, you're not alone in this. I mean, there are lots of people in this situation that you really, really work hard to get something, but then when you get it, it seems like it's been too easy, and now the job or the assignment or whatever is easy to do, and you're sort of disappointed, and you feel it's kind of, why did you work so hard? Why did you worry so much about this?
It's as if the ease with getting the job then taints the job.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How would Joy cope with that?
Well,
it's all on you, doctor. No, I mean, what kind of tools can we offer her?
Joy, I really think you have to look at where you're getting satisfaction in your life. Are you getting it anywhere? Or is this a problem that sort of taints your whole pattern of behavior? And if you're not getting it anywhere, then you have to really need to start over and look at your values. And I really suggest mindfulness practice for you.
That does sound good. Again, that looking at how you behave without judging it, but just kind of noticing it.
Yes. Yes, and reflecting and getting to know yourself with, as I referred to before, compassionate curiosity.
Oh, yes.
Why do I do this? Without judging, without being harsh on yourself, but what am I getting out of this? Or what old script am I acting out? Or who am I trying to please? Or, you know, really, you know, you can do a great deal of self-analysis.
Mm-hmm. I like that compassionate curiosity. Let's go to Paula in Yardley, Pennsylvania. Hi, Paula.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm 83 years old. I buried my husband about 2 months old, 2 months ago. He was over 100 years, and for the last 10 years, I've spent most... I kept him at home, and he was... not very mobile, so my days really were taken up with taking care of him and taking mm-hmm. him to his doctors and what have you. Mm-hmm. Now I'm feeling my house is a mess. My bedroom looks as though I'm a hoarder, and yet I wake up each morning and I'm just struck with inertia. Mm-hmm. I cannot get up. I can take my grandchildren to to whatever they need to do, I'm good there. But to get, I get back to my house and just get back into bed and pull the covers up again. So I really need some guidance.
Well, Paula, first I want to say I'm sorry for your loss and what a loving, caring spouse you were to take care of your husband. Doctor, what would you say?
Well, Paula, it sounds to me like you're probably just dealing with grief. I mean, you know, after a lifetime together, to lose your husband like this is a major, major loss, and you need time to let it sink in and move on. The process of grief can take years. And so you really have to be patient with yourself. And I think if you manage to get through the day with your grandchildren and other activities and then come home and collapse, that's not so bad for the time being. You know, tell yourself that...
I have to sell my house now. And
yes.
That's urgent because...
Oh, that's another major loss.
Oh, my goodness. You're dealing with a lot, Paula.
Yes. Just the way life goes on, I guess. I mean, I am in reasonably good health, so I should be... I'm grateful each day when I wake up and the sun is shining.
That's beautiful.
But these are the two most stressful things in a person's life.
I just don't know where to start.
Oh.
We've only got a minute left, Doctor. Paul is dealing with a lot. Any quick suggestions to help her not only deal with the loss of her husband at the move?
I suggest that, Paula, you start at the top. You start with what's right in front of your face, and you do it. And when you've done it, you congratulate yourself and then give yourself time to rest. And then when you've rested, take the next thing in the pile. You've got a great big thing here to digest, and you just have to take it one bite at a time.
Dr. Richard O'Connor, thank you so much for joining me today, and Paula, good luck to you. I'm Nancy Giles. I've been speaking with psychotherapist Richard O'Connor, author of several books, including Rewire, Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, and Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior. On Monday's show, Duarte Geraldino guest hosts. He'll speak with former New York Times columnist Anand Giridharadas, who argues that the global elite are fighting to preserve the status quo. Then Kalita Brohis talks about her new book, I Should Have Honor, a memoir of hope and pride in Pakistan. Plus Lisa Brennan Jobs discusses her memoir, Small Fry, about growing up as the daughter of artist Christian Brennan and Steve Jobs in a rapidly changing Silicon Valley. And find out what we might have more in common with termites than we ever imagined. Our show is produced by Catherine Millsop, Ursula Summer, Jules Dodson, and Sam Anderson. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Matt Mirando was at the audio controls. And we had help today from contributing producer Angela Sheldon. Thanks so much for listening, and join us again on Monday.